podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Anfield Wrap. It's a special edition this Monday. It's the Anfield Wrap in the style of the award-winning Transfer Gutter Show, which only those who are privileged or wise enough to subscribe to our tour player service get to listen to. The Gutter Show comes out three times a week during the transfer window. But we're going to give you a little flavour of it here. I'm Rob Gutman. I'm standing in for Neil Atkinson, who is looking at me. He is going to contribute to the transfer chit-chat. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Jake Nolan's here as well, and he's producing, and Neil Jones is here as well. So, boys, where do we start? I always pose that question to myself whilst trying to gain my composure. Jake, I was reading a piece by Paul Gorst in The Echo this morning. He was talking about the shortening shortlist of targets for Liverpool, midfielders in particular. And something sort of jumped out to me a little bit here. It's that two of the hottest links we've had for a number of weeks now have been Kefren Turan from Nice and Ryan Gravenberch from Bayern Munich. They're both represented by Rafaela Pimenta, same agent.
Is that so?
That is so. Apparently she was a guest of the club earlier in the year, visited Anfield, went to the club shop, all that sort of shizzle. Yeah,
Love and Rockets.
Yeah. Well, yeah, she might have gone to some hostelries around the city and enjoyed herself. but, yeah, let's stay serious for just for a few more minutes. I'm trying to be professional here. Jake, so I thought it's interesting because there's a number of, we're hearing these names over and over again, this shortlist. This week it's Vega, next week it's Manu Kone, likes Turam and Gravenberch. These names are coming thick and fast. Liverpool can't sign all of these motherfuckers.
Can they not?
No, they can't.
That would be good, wouldn't it?
We would love this to happen, but it's not going to happen. But it struck me as interesting that if you're talking to one agent who represents two on the list, Ryan Gravenberch and also, in this case, Kefren Turam, they can't be played off. Do you know what I mean? The agent's going to go, so which of my clients do you actually want to sign? Are you taking the piss out of us a little here? Or are you signing both? And I think it's an interesting dynamic. I'm joining dots in a very dodgy way and saying, maybe we want both Gravenberch and Turan. What about this for a theory?
Yeah, I quite like it, to be honest with you. As a man who likes to kill two birds with one stone myself, you know, if I can send one email as opposed to multiple emails, I will.
I know,
so,
right?
So if Liverpool are taking that on as a transfer policy, then I'm all for it. Not least because they're two good players. It's, you know, to kind of skim over the links in general, I was thinking about this on the way, and I'm normally quite sort of like laid back with Liverpool's dealings, and you know they know what they're doing.
You're on the wrong show, mate.
Yeah, no, exactly. But I'm like, right, get your hands in your pocket, you minge bags, because I don't want to watch what I watched again last season, and it suddenly occurred to me that like next season isn't that far away now. We are getting closer. You know, we've probably had our summer. It's probably over now, isn't it? So I think we need another couple more bodies in there. If we can do that with one email, then Rob, I'm all for it.
Neil Jones. I'm going to have to keep clarifying that all the way through in a room full of Neils. The pressure is mounting from the fans, obviously, to get stuff done. Neil, Akko and I were talking earlier, though, about the reasons for the possible delays you're seeing in the market at the moment. Mm. I posited to Neil, there's a lot of potentially willing sellers out there who've got saleable assets. Chelsea have got lots of players they want to sell. Relegated Leicester have got good ones. Bayern are letting it be known and not be known that they'd sell a few. I think there's a sort of a level of a game needing to be played out where these willing sellers can't allow themselves to be seen to be too willing to have their pants taken down. So therefore, they're almost setting themselves artificial deadlines. And once we hit this magical date, which we don't know, then we'll see this market move.
Yeah, and the Saudi element, I think, has to be factored in. If you look at Wolves just suddenly getting this, the captain goes, probably someone they wouldn't have got half what they're getting for him from if they were selling him to a, you know, a European club. Now they're getting 47 million for him. That changes their prospects. It changes their mind. Chelsea looks like they're selling half their squad to Saudi, and that really does benefit them. You know, there's a whole other show to be done on sort of why that's happening and whether that should be allowed. But that changes their desperation to sell, doesn't it? And potentially their negotiations for other players that they don't want to sell, Mount, for example. I think as well, just the Premier League is so well financed, isn't it? That, you know, unless you've got a release clause, why do you have to take the first bid that comes in for Declan Rice or for, you know, even for, as you say, if you're Leicester, if you're James Maddison and people like that. So I think there's a lot of things that are going to move. I think the Saudis probably the one that not many people maybe predicted would have such an impact. You know, you're seeing now players, or a player at least, but then there's going to be others. Ziyech, I think, Koulibaly, Mendy with are they the three?
They're the three. Yeah.
I'm sure Pulisic will be thrown in for free at some point in that negotiation. But you're seeing players now in the sort of 20s and early 30s, as opposed to like the sort of the veterans tour. You're seeing that those players being targeted by, you know, Saudi clubs. I think that does add an extra dimension to it, and I think maybe there'll be a bit of waiting to see where all the cards fall and who needs what and who's got, you know, has filled a gap in their balance sheets by just offloading a few players to there.
Just the I mean, the first and foremost, Neil's right to say it's a whole other show, the Saudi Arabian question, not least because it also throws in to the pot the staggering idea that the Premier League doesn't actually know who provides 60% of Chelsea's ownership company. The other 40% is Clearview, but they don't know and they don't have to ask. There's loads of bits of football. I think if you actually look at football for the last 15 years, if you want to go back to Abramovich, I think that one of the issues around conversations around football regulation and what the rules are and how the rules operate is that all the rulemaking bodies are always behind the curve, and they've just been behind every single curve over and over again. I think the Saudi thing's deeply depressing. The idea that they can sort of, and as I say, that without there being clarity over who owns what, there's other ways and means for that to happen as well, with reference to Newcastle, where if Newcastle needed to turn something around, it doesn't feel beyond the realms of possibility, and there's nothing to guard against this, literally nothing. I don't think it's complicated for there to have been a rule that stated that nation states should not be allowed to invest in football clubs. I don't think that's complicated at all. Or nation states as sovereign funds shouldn't be allowed to invest in football clubs. But it's not there, and it's still not even there in the crouch of you, and there's understandable reasons why for that, because it actually becomes a foreign policy remit. That if they were to have put that in, you've got to include the Foreign Office in around that, because that's now the way this is. But the Premier League can set its own rules, and it's chosen not to. And let's be really clear about this. Liverpool haven't been behind that. You know, Liverpool haven't backed the Crouch Review, and Liverpool have not pushed for increased regulation around who does or doesn't own football clubs or those rules. I think Liverpool have also been the opposite of beneficiaries of that, I would argue, and will continue to be. And I think that Everton have been 10 times that, frankly, and that hasn't been recognised. And also they've now been open to what's gone on with reference to the Mashiri stuff. The Saudi stuff is just absolutely downright miserable. And I think
it's inflating the market is the key thing for this stage. To be parochial about it.
Clear Lake. Sorry, Andy's correcting me. It's Clear Lake, the 40% Chelsea ownership that we know about, they call Clear Lake. Yeah, no, it's inflating the market. In the short term, it inflates the market. But as I say, the long-term thing is the people who've been running football and administering football and setting the rules for football are genuinely always 10 years behind what is happening in reality and on the ground. And there's no reason to think that that's going to change anytime soon. And I genuinely just think it is just a bit rubbish. And they're going to have to be better. But I don't think there's any onus on them to be better. You know, this is in the week where we're still talking about Manchester City in the final and what's gone on there in a completely different sphere. But the same issue with the fact that no one's able to see any degree into the future. And yes, it might come as a little bit of a surprise that they've chosen to do this. But you had, for instance, the fact that China chose to do something not dissimilar a fair few years back. But now you've actually got a situation where you've allowed 80% of Newcastle to be owned by the public investment fund of a country, and a country that then has chosen to invest in football. And it's also not a surprise it went to the 2030 World Cup, because it's been telling everyone that for 5 years. Everyone's got to be better, and the truth of the matter is that everyone's getting worse and the situation's getting worse, and that's got knock-on effect for everybody. And in this instance, in your very guttery instance, in the short term, it in part inflates the market, but what it also means is that there's an escape valve for clubs that have actually been run really badly and somewhat fucked themselves. They've now got valve.
You stick with the behind the curve. The authorities were behind the curve in January when Chelsea started giving these 10-year contracts out, and everyone said, hang on, what are they doing? And then went, oh yeah, you can't do that anymore. But they've already done it, and now they've also got the ability to just cut the losses on some of these players anyway. So I mean, I saw a sort of breakdown of Koulibaly. It was, you know, last summer you looked at that signing and went, that's a strange one, sort of 29, you know.
It's a mistake.
Yeah, they've got away with it. You know, they basically, it's cost them about £8 million, I think, you know, in terms of his wages, basically, and that's it, and they'll make it back. So that's the other thing, is it takes, I mean, Wolves were in a terrible situation. You know, there was talk the manager was going to resign because of FFP. You know, all of a sudden, there you go, reset, and we'll go again. And I'm sure you'll see Wolves now linked with players for £20-odd million and buy them when they shouldn't, you know, theoretically be in a position to do that, but it does give clubs a chance to correct recent mistakes pretty easily.
Well, I mean, I don't want to over-digress on this, but it's backdoor investment in clubs, because effectively if they're overpaying, and they're not motivated to overpay for the sake of overpaying, what they're saying is we are sustaining you, and there has to be some contra arrangements around it. We actually could see reversed, if you use the expression, it's not the correct expression, but I know what I mean, reverse takeovers, whereby people reconstitute Premier League clubs effectively in the Saudi Arabian League just by buying the assets. But let's stop this right now, because we are...
Because it is another show, and I will make that show.
This is the sort of lively discussion we have.
I think it does impact the transfer market this summer, though, because it's so new as well. I think because we're seeing... I don't think everyone knows really what
I think the other thing that it does is it's another thing that actually puts a pause on things. And I think from a Liverpool point of view, one of the things we've wanted is for things to move quite quickly. But it's perfectly reasonable for everyone now to spend 10 days trying to work out if they've got any assets that they feel as though they can flog there. Ringing up players, ringing up agents, ringing up those clubs, seeing where it is. And for the clubs who've made mistakes where we felt that the market was going to punish them or correct them this summer, I mean, the only relief is that there is practically no Everton player who would be of any interest whatsoever to this nation, Saudi Arabian League.
A little fella.
The other side as well is obviously you don't know what, I'm not saying this has happened with Liverpool, but you don't know what some of these players are getting a little wink that, look, you know, let's say Thiago with 1 year left on his deal, Liverpool have planned this season, and they say, well, we'll give you, we'll triple that. You know,
yeah, like, Stevie, how are we?
Exactly. Liverpool aren't better than this, let's be crystal clear, because if they were, they'd have spoken out by now, and they haven't spoken out yet again on regulatory matters.
And if Liverpool had 10 assets that you'd say, you know, they don't play, but we could sell them, I think a lot of fans would be saying, let's ring up Gerrard and see if he fancies
anyone. Before we move on from it, though, one thing I've been thinking about the last couple of days is, do you know, like, when Chelsea were doing all that bizarre business and a couple of other people started, you know, the way they're operating the city, Newcastle, do you think they knew that this was coming? Because I just don't think it's happened like last week, and that's how it's been. It's like they've known, they might have had that button that they can press in 6 months.
Yeah, I think we're really digressing, so we won't go too far.
Sorry, Rob.
But there's also been the change to the work permit rules in the Premier League, hasn't there, where, you know, all of a sudden now, players that you couldn't get, you know, from South America, for example, you can get now on your work permit with this special clause or special dispensation sort of relaxation of the rules. So there's a lot of things, but clubs have known about that for 12 months. You know, they've been lobbying for that. So that's like sort of sees like, oh, that's a change of strategy. It's not really, you know, Chelsea signed up some young Brazilians, I think, Andre Santos in January, pretty much knowing that this was coming in. So, yeah, I don't think clubs are in the dark about these major things around it. You know, they're probably thinking get in before the rule change comes in, aren't
they're
they?
They're all bad bastards, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, okay.
There's your headline.
Well, we're on the cusp of some sort of revolution which doesn't feel too dissimilar to the China one. I can only hope that it fizzles out the way the situation did with China a few years ago, when it looked like they were going to buy everybody. Remember them stealing that Ford whose name escapes me away from Liverpool? What was his name again?
Alex Teixeira.
Where are they now?
Oscar's still there.
Is he?
Yeah.
Well, okay, right. But back in the here and now and Liverpool's immediate reality, well, it's all in Liverpool's immediate reality, but very specifically, Neil Jones, there was talk... I think Gorstia at The Echo was saying in his article that Liverpool aren't ruling out sending a delegation to the European Under-21 Championships about to start in Romania and Bulgaria, I think, because so many on the shortlist are Under-21 players. Turam, Gravenberch, Vega, Kone, they're all there, all these boys. It seems a bit mad, and yet... Again, that's Liverpool's reality.
Just with flyers on the strip.
Exactly.
Free shot, lads. Come on.
Any chances, lads?
Yeah, I mean, look, Gravenberch, Turam, Kone. There's plenty. There's plenty of interest there. I don't know if that's the case. But I think it gives something for fans to get stuck into in this Under-21s tournament, doesn't it? I think there'll be a lot of Euro pop YouTube compilations getting made in the next few weeks of you know, Turam against X and Kone against X. But I think it's clear. I think you can draw a sort of a decent line where Liverpool tend to buy players. We've said this, I think you said it on a previous show about McAllister. They tend to buy them when they've proven something, but they've got something to prove. When they're at an age where they're young enough to get better, but you can sort of have a decent look at where they're at, and they've played a certain amount of games in their club football, and usually it's between 150, 250. So most of those players, I think, fall into close to that category. Most of the players we've talked about, Gravenberch, Turam, Kone, I think you've got Timber on this agenda. I mean, he's a defender, but he would go into that. So I think you can sort of start to follow these names and with a degree of confidence that at the very least Liverpool are interested in them rather than, you know, certain players. Like, I saw links with Pavard, for example. As soon as you saw that, I think you just thought, doesn't really make any sense unless Liverpool are changing something. I think if you look at Gabri Vega, he looks a little bit more of a gamble sort of player. These other guys,
he's got a release clause.
And listen, there will be exceptions for if he is just an exceptional player. I'm not sure on that one, but I think these other guys who are at this tournament, I think there is general sort of an obvious thread that you can say, well, yeah, they fit the bill for Liverpool, and Liverpool are keen.
Yeah, I'm noticing, Jake, with the links of these type of midfielders to Liverpool, that they are all almost in parallel getting linked to, let's pick some names, actually Chelsea, Newcastle, Man United even. And I think that's kind of fascinating. You can see why. It makes all the sense in the world, because these are teams all in or about the Champions League, places either they've got in last season or they're hoping to get back in, or they might drop out. It's fascinating to me that we're all in a competition of sorts. And it's made me think about what the relative pitches of these sides are. And from a Liverpool point of view, well, we're not in the Champions League, so you might think we suddenly go to the back of the queue like we were years ago when we seemed to be perennially up against Borussia Dortmund and Tottenham of a summer, I remember. But this time out, I noticed something. The bookies released odds for the new season and for the title. Liverpool were second favourites. It's about 8 to 1. It depends where you look. 8 to 1 second favourites for the title. I kind of feel if I was, representing Liverpool, talking to an agent, I wouldn't be slow to point that out. I wouldn't be going, yes, Newcastle are in the Champions League, but we're still better than them. Yes, Man United are in the Champions League, but we are likelier to finish in the top two than they are in the top four.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to address is, you know, certainly in this day and age as well, there's no secrets in football, is there? You know, if you're going to go after good players, especially good players within the European sphere, then other clubs are going to know about them, especially clubs that, you know, you're shopping in the same shops, so to speak. I don't think Liverpool's a difficult sell at all, not just because I'm sitting here with, you know, bleeding Liverpool blood, so to speak, but it's ultimately, if you're a midfielder, certainly you're going to go in and make an impact. And also the chance that you might go and do a year in the Europa League before you stand up into the Champions League, I think as a young developing player, that there's no really better way to do that. Obviously, any footballer and any agent will tell you, yeah, they want to be playing Champions League football. But if you've got the chance to do that via a campaign in the Europa League to kind of bed yourself in a little bit, I think that's fine. And that's what I'm excited about with the players that we're getting linked with, is I think, you know, we've had players come in maybe over the past 4 or 5 years who for lack of a better term, you don't know whether they're going straight into the first 11. You don't know they're going to better what we already had. I think anyone who comes in now is who we're building the team around the next 4 or 5 years. And that's an incredibly exciting point. And I'll happily tell any player that with my Liverpool hat on.
I think Gary Neville talked about it, about United in the 90s and the early 2000s. He said that every summer, no matter what, it was Liverpool that sort of, if they made a good sign and it was them, who'd sort of look and see the first 5 games of the season and go, let's see what, like, I wonder if they're back. And usually they weren't, unfortunately. I think there's an element of that with City. I think City, it's telling that Arsenal's big two signings last summer really were from City. There's no way City would sell two squad players to Liverpool, even now. Even Liverpool fit. They wouldn't give Gundogan and Bernardo Silva to Liverpool now, you know, even if they thought they were past their worth for City. They will still look at Liverpool this summer and in the first few weeks of the season go, I hope their decline is permanent. I hope they're sort of still on their haunches. That's the reason I think that bookmakers thing is, you know, who are the ones that can take City? And there's only one team that's shown it. Arsenal showed it for a bit, didn't get to 90 points. Liverpool have done it 3 times in the last 5 seasons. They're the only ones that have shown that they can, over the course of a season, take City on.
Yeah, course and distance is a thing. It was dead interesting. I did something that'll be out, I think, today with Jordan Jarrett Bryan talking about Arsenal behind our paywall. And I was out now, and he says it was interesting because he was like, it's hard that. Like, you know, it was like, it was intense. It both up on the show and then chatting to him afterwards. And Arsenal didn't go all the way, really. And in fact, they only had the intense bit for about sort of 2 months. We've had arguably three seasons, three and a bit if you include the start of this one, where we feel like we've had it every game, like just as supporters, before you even get to the idea of the footballers. Liverpool have got course and distance, and I think that that is the key thing. You know, if you're going to try and go toe-to-toe with this Man City team, while simultaneously acknowledging, and I think it's really important to acknowledge, firstly, it's not absolutely infallible. It was in a situation where on game 28, it had 64 points. That was 20. It dropped 20 points by game 28, this time City. And more I think about it and talk about it is I want us to not think about them, ideally for sort of 10-12 games, the first 10-12 games of the season, in part to enjoy it more, but also because I don't think it does anyone good to feel like you kick off 1-0 down. The thing that happened to Arsenal, everyone used to say in title run-ins, hey, I tell you what, it's good if you play first, or it's not. It didn't matter when you're going with City. And the reason why it doesn't matter is you just presume they're going to win.
Mm-hmm.
So if they haven't won, you're playing thinking, well, we've got to win because they're going to win. And if they have played, you're actually, they've probably won. At which point you think, well, we've got to win because they've won. Like it did, the force of it is, no matter what happens, they're going to win. So you've just got to win. And that's before you've kicked a ball.
And it got to the stage at Liverpool as well, where when they didn't win, it put so much pressure on the game. It was like, that's the last one they're ever going to not win. You know, I remember being in the petrol station outside St. Mary's, second game of the season, the year Liverpool won the league and City drew with Spurs 2-2, and thought, that's a massive moment. And that was in August. That was August.
It was game two.
Yeah, and he'd been to the Euro Super Cup in the midweek and Adrian was in goal and the fan had nearly done his ankle and all. And it was like, wow, that was a big win for Liverpool. That was in August. And I remember thinking, I can't do this for a season. Like, this is too much. And there was a moment this season, just gone, where I think they played, who did they play, R5? Was it Brentford, maybe? R5 on a Saturday, yeah. And City had played in the day and beat someone. And I thought, it's lovely, this. I don't care. You know, like, I think they scored while I was walking up to the stadium, and City winning 1-0. Okay.
Do you know what? On equal sentiments as well, you know, when Coutinho bagged in a second on that day that we all kind of try and block out our memories. I remember in the pub turning around to my mate going, no, they're still going to do it. Like still, yeah. Stone cold face. I went the other way.
I thought Liverpool had done it.
And obviously proved right. I'm not trying to be as smart as, but the same. That's not enjoyable. I should have had my top off. Mm. You know what I mean? But I didn't.
So this, I think, so course and distance, I think really, really matters. And until I see someone else do it properly, I'm going to say we're the only ones who can do it.
In the cups as well, by the way.
Yeah.
And also Liverpool, City beat Liverpool once in a real live game. In a title season, it was decisive in the end. Obviously, the Sane, the 6 millimeters or 12 millimeters, whatever it was, just after the New Year. But every other game, they wiped the floor with Arsenal in the two games. So that's the other thing, isn't it? You know, Liverpool, every time they've sort of been in there, they've kept City honest in that race. Whereas City will still have this feeling that it's only Arsenal. They've only got our rejects, you know, and we battered them last season in the cup and in the league. So Liverpool have still got that fear factor. And if not with us, maybe we don't have as much faith in them as other people in the league.
And they feel like they can wipe the floor with United whatever they want, and they've got Newcastle in there as well. So I think if I was doing Liverpool's pitch, as Jake says before, you're young, building the back of this, but we've still got enough lads who know how this works. The manager knows how this works. We've got a plan for it. But there's 6 months here where we can all get ourselves in, get our heads right, go from there and see where we are year one. And the Europa League stuff, I think, does actually, it helps that process. It might not help you convince the players, but I think it helps that process massively because it's six games, group games, where Liverpool, they can't play whoever they want, but they can at least have a look at different things as they go.
Exactly. And you know, a young player coming in, you can quite clearly say to them, you're going to play somewhere between 5 and 10 European games this season. Whereas if you're in the Champions League campaign, you couldn't say that with a straight face.
Starts.
Yeah,
starts. Exactly. Not just. Not, we're not going to give you 10 minutes at the end. Yeah. Starts.
And we're going win it.
Okay. I want to move on to something which I read in a James Pearce article at the weekend. I'll go to you on it, Neil Jones. He talked about Liverpool's criteria before they even get to the point of pitching, I suppose. And he said, well, I think he'd obviously been briefed on. He said within the Anfield hierarchy, they talk about the three A's in choosing a player: ability, availability, and affordability. Now that sounds cool. That sounds like a good little mantra to have. But to caution maybe, or maybe cynicism from me on this one. One of those is important. They're very important. Ability. In fact, that one should be trump everything else. I felt for years availability and affordability are very, very, loom very large for Liverpool. And there's a slight risk, I think, no, a considerable risk, actually, let's call it, that you deviate yourself from getting the right player by getting the affordable player or the player who's gettable. Is there a danger, do you think? I don't know. What's your assessment of how wise Liverpool are to the balance here?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, I think availability is to play as opposed to get. I think affordability is to get the player. I think availability is how many games do they play.
Okay, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
when,
sure,
when you've
sure,
got them,
sure.
How what their fitness record is.
How many times you get them on the pitch in the season,
so,
sure.
Yeah, but yeah, I think we just have to be fair, don't we? Liverpool have always worked on this idea that they don't really take that many, what we would call sort of gambles, you know, in the market. They might take it on a player that we haven't heard of or a player that we wouldn't necessarily have signed. I think Gakpo's a good example of that. I don't think all of us were sitting there saying he's the one Liverpool need at this moment. Go and get him. But I'm talking about gambles in terms of just give him that extra 10 million. You know, Liverpool do not sign Casemiro last summer, do they? You know, that's you'd say that's paid off for United. There might be a moment in the next couple of years where you go, they've lumbered themselves, haven't they? Although they'd probably flog them to Saudi.
Wouldn't go for Harry Kane, would they?
They wouldn't go for Harry Kane now. Absolutely, you can completely rule that out. You know, I think there was links with Kimmich sort of briefly, recently. I mean, I think he's amazing. I think he'd be an amazing signing, but Liverpool aren't going to do that. So that's the affordability element to it. I think that's been probably too important to Liverpool, for not necessarily out of choice, but through just sort of the way that they have the ownership structure is and the model is, that if it doesn't make sense financially, then yeah, it can override that ability element. I think what the problem has always been with Liverpool is where they've gone to after that. So they've either gone to the wrong player in some instances, you know, Arthur Mollo. Or they've gone to nobody. And I think that last summer was the biggest one, wasn't it? It was like, okay, are you telling me there was nobody who took the three A's last summer for Liverpool in midfield? I don't believe you. Personally, you know, you might say, oh, we got done by Bellingham, we thought we were gonna get him, and we took that gamble. I don't believe it. Personally, I think Liverpool could have signed a midfielder last summer who ticked those boxes.
Yeah, okay. I want to talk about other factors outside of our direct control, which could be affecting our thinking, Jake. Actually, Klopp hinted towards the end of last season that Liverpool's targeting of type of player was being affected by the results they were getting with their new formation. Grist to that mill has been added by Gareth Southgate playing Trent Alexander-Arnold in midfield, and at the time of recording is likely to do so again tonight. Post-match, around the game, both he and Trent were quite enthused by it. And Trent, I think Gareth talked about, they said, well, if we continue the experiment with Trent, but much depends on his club and whether his club play him in midfield. It feels subtly as if more and more pressure is being put on Jurgen Klopp and Liverpool to make Trent Alexander as a midfielder become something closer to a fixture. Whether that means he can't still be the hybrid midfielder that he is at the moment and still play for his country or not. But I think when Klopp and Trent are having one-to-ones, Trent is going to be increasingly expressing the desire to play as something akin to a midfielder. That being the case, does this put more and more focus for Liverpool on needing to acquire right-sided defensive players?
Possibly, and I would do so anyway, because I feel like we're short in that area no matter what. But there's a couple of things there, and you know, we had a good chat on Twitter, didn't we? I'm becoming a little bit tiresome of this personally, because who was the first person to put centre midfield? It was Jurgen Klopp, and that was to solve something. You know, he's to step in. In similar aspects, you look across the M62. John Stones is doing a similar sort of job for City. Nobody's calling for John Stones to play number 10 for England. You know, he's doing his job for his club really, really well, and he's stepping into midfield and he's finding where he plays. The thing with Trent is, what you're not going to learn from what the other night is, if you told me that he could play number 10 for England against Malta and run the game, of course he could. Of course he could. The problem is when you're going to be playing against, you know, your top level Premier League oppositions, can he go and do that? And I just don't think you're learning it from that. And I've got a lot of time for Southgate in the terms of what he's done away from the football pitch and his kind of values and everything he's put through. But I think time and time again, this is another instance of it. He finds himself a little bit behind the curve when it comes to on-the-field tactics because, you know, England have got really, really good right full-backs, yeah. But if his way to get strength into that team is to play number 10, then they're going to get found out ultimately when they get to tournament football. And I don't think no pressure should be put on Jurgen Klopp at all because he's the guy who's one, got sent into the team in the first place as right full-back, and two, got the best out of him by stepping into midfield.
There's going to be differences of opinion, subtle differences of opinion on this. I think everyone's quite pleased. I mean, you and Jake, we're not entirely on the same page, but we're all broadly agreeing that there is a midfield direction of travel for Trent. I don't think anyone's really imagining that this time next year we're talking about Trent as being a right-back in the sense that he has been for the majority of his Liverpool career. But regardless of what you think's the best solution, all of us as amateur tacticians, the mood music around him in midfield, it is only getting louder and it's only going to get a bit louder, I feel, for a while. And even though Trent's not going to bash Klopp's door down, Neil, there is a pressure there, even if it's a sort of implied pressure.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's probably the most interesting part of it. I agree with Jake about the Malta thing, but the flip side of that is Liverpool play some Maltas. You know, at least if you know he can do it against a lesser opposition, where you've got all the ball, that's potentially 10 games a season in Liverpool, you know, in the Europa League or in the Premier League at home against teams that sit deep and do these things. They're not, Malta, obviously not at the level of Premier League clubs, but
a team that low blocks.
Their approaches and the sort of game that you're going to be playing in is a little bit similar. But I think the biggest thing is just how he seems, Trent, and I wonder what that conversation's like with Jürgen. Is it a case of, this is it, this is where I want to play, you know, look, give me a chance in pre-season, I'm gonna make it so you cannot not put me in midfield. That might be the case. I mean, I'm not sure what Jürgen's reaction would be like to that. I don't think what's been happening can go on for a whole season. I don't think you can have him doing those two roles.
The hybrid role,
I thought it was exposed enough in the last games that Liverpool did well in and won in it. You know, there was games where you're watching Nottingham Forest and Tottenham and Leeds sort of being precarious and you're watching going, just put someone there, stand on their left winger, and it wasn't happening. And it was thinking that you can't do it the whole season. Canate will be dead. You know, that carries on, you know, from just doing sprints for the whole 90 minutes. Trent will be in a bad position, you know, physically. So something will have to change, whether it's just a subtle change of trend, just, okay, we've got everyone sort of on pins that you're going to do that, and now you can just go and have loads of space on the right, or whether you start playing a right back in there with them, which we haven't seen yet, really, have we, apart from for England. I think there's a lot to figure out, and it's going to be interesting because I think the first question Jürgen gets asked from a press conference is going to be, apart from transfers, it's going to be Trent. And what are you going to do with him? What's going to be next?
100%.
The problem with the idea of if you're not going to persist with this, let's start off with, if you're going to persist with this, but you're going to use him higher, then he presumably plays where Henderson plays. But Henderson doesn't get on the ball as much as he gets on the ball.
Yeah.
So that's gone.
That role would have to change.
That role would have to change. If you go back to playing the idea of the way Liverpool used to play, then, you know, with the 2-3-5 in possession or 2-5-3, depending on how you look at it, then you need someone else to go and play outside of him. And the point of the three, when it was 2-3-5, was that three existed to build a platform for the five to go and play. So you're then taking him and saying, by the way, can you just go into the middle of the park there and do loads and loads of graft for Timber, who's now playing right-hand side, or Pavard, hypothetically, I know Neil, but someone now. So can you do loads of graft to create that platform? So it's not going to work that way either. So what you're effectively saying is you want the manager to rebuild around this thing when he already, in a couple of ways, what he's aimed to do is to build the right around Salah and Trent. All the way through, he's tried to build it around Salah and Trent. But I think if you then have a situation where Salah and Trent are really close to each other a lot of the time, it becomes harder to build it around both of them at once. Part of why he's been able to build it around the strength of Salah and Trent at its best, no matter what we've done, is the starting positions, there's 40 yards between them. If you say, now you're a midfielder, you're further forward, so now there's 20 yards between them, and that's harder again. I still think if Liverpool
If we were to say you're moving him into midfield and you're going to imagine how you think it can work with him being a midfielder with a fullback, then I think you go into a playmaking six.
Yeah, million. Yeah.
I think you go into the idea of he plays number six as a playmaker, and you cop for the fact that at times he might it'll take a bit of time to get used to the other stuff running off him. I still don't see how it works where Henderson is in the current setup, which I think Henderson and Jones are much closer to tens than they are to eights, as we said in terms of starting position, as we've said in the past. They have
put
to do lots of work
in there as well.
Yeah. I think you're looking at, you know, and you can throw McAllister in there. I don't think it works there. I think the idea, therefore, of going back to right back and it becoming like a traditional eight thing, I don't think that quite works. The only way I think it works where he gets to see the whole pitch, because the other part of this is the way Liverpool set up is it's about where you arrive onto the ball. It's where you arrive onto the ball. And Liverpool play so high for so many games, including against good teams, that footballers who may think, yeah, I do a lot of work in the eight role, well, actually, you're picking it up in the eight role as Liverpool's deepest lying midfielder. That's where you're actually picking it up, and that's the bit of the pitch you can see. Think about the roles rather than literally how you write them down in starting positions. So I think the only way, genuinely, in which I can envisage, unless there is another really quite profound change of shape and approach, if Liverpool are going to revert back to what they did at the end of last season, or revert back to, and let's be clear about this as well, there's always been loads of flexibility in what Klopp did at his best. It's important not to sort of say it was always the same thing every week, because it wasn't. There's a reason why, for instance, the Champions League team, final team that wins in Madrid, only ever plays together once. It's because Adam Lallana got games, Shaqiri got games, other footballers got dipped in and out. Henderson would play a number of games at six when Liverpool wants to move the ball faster. Milner would get games. These were all different footballers. You know, Liverpool rocked up to two consecutive home derbies playing 4-4-2, basically because I think they thought Everton were crap and they were just going to absolutely steam them, and had a plan for it, and then executed that plan because guess what? They steamed them. So I'm very much of the view that if, but all of that said, if they're doing it, I feel as though he plays number six. If you're going to go back to the way it was, he plays number six. If you're going to stick with what we've currently got, and I do take Neil's point that at the end of it, there might be some Liverpool players turning around to the manager and going, I don't enjoy this. The flip side is, I suspect Virgil van Dijk could be saying, we can keep this if you don't mind, as far as I'm concerned. Trent would be saying, we can keep this. Salah would be saying, we can keep this. But I think you'd end up in a situation where I don't quite see where it works, where you think you're going to get this full range out of him, unless he plays as the deepest, if we're playing a three-man midfield. I don't think it works anywhere else.
I've got a mad shout. Not for this
you're
season.
Going to play him left wing? Because I play him left wing.
No. Well, you're not miles off of me. I'm wondering if Trent is a possibly our Salah succession plan in the longer term. In that I can see Klopp reverting to his Dortmund 4-2-3-1. Trent could go wide of the three as he played during the youth teams. Salah could drop as a 10 in between times, by the way. He has experimented with Salah as a 10. You could have Nunes ahead of him or whoever. Lille, am I mad?
I don't think you're mad, no. It crossed my mind that at some point Liverpool do have to start looking over the cliff and going Van Dijk, Salah, Robertson. Yeah. Obviously Henderson's probably there now. You know, what do we do here? You know, imagine the player Liverpool sign when Mo Salah leaves. Imagine the pressure that he's going to be under, you know, coming in the side. What, you got 14 goals by Christmas? Get him out of our club. You know, that's the level we're talking. So I wouldn't say Trent is a replacement for Salah, but if you can get him into a position where he's just De Bruyne-style player, you've got less need for a Salah
doing those kind of things.
So you've got, I can see that element to it where.
But what you're talking about though is it works if
you've
got
2 years away, by the way.
But also, but this is the big thing on the idea of the post Salah thing is that in our heads, and I think it's really important, just because we've had a period of time where the main goal scorer plays off the right, that doesn't mean that's always the case. I mean, most football teams have the main goal scorer as a number
nine.
There's
a couple of other things. We haven't yet seen Nunes, have we, in that position where he pretty much should be the one who benefits the most from Trent in midfield, shouldn't he? Because he's the one who makes those runs that Trent finds with those straight-ish sort of chip through balls. We haven't seen Thiago in the same team as Trent, because that would be wild to see Trent doing midfield and Thiago doing midfield. And so
I don't think we ever will.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's any coincidence that Thiago was fit for a bit of that and Curtis played ahead of him, didn't he? And Henderson played. So,
and then they sent Thiago for the operation, which they might not even have had to do. Yeah. But they felt comfortable enough to say, you go and get yourself right.
You know, there was 12 months ago, if Thiago's fit, I mean, look at the fuss around the Champions League final. That was the big talk. That was it, wasn't it? You know, God, please, Thiago be fit. You know, get him through this warm-up, make sure he plays and all that. There's a few things that still haven't been tried in this position. And I also think that the other one for this season definitely is, where's Fabinho at? You know, what's the sort of... Was that was that just a sort of a, or was that sort of, was that the horror movie that I suspect, I'm on that side of the idea that that was the end of Fabinho or the beginning of the end.
Yeah.
If not, if he gets back to a level where it's just the old Fabinho.
Well, that opens the door for what Neil was saying
as well, doesn't it? It gives you a lot more possibilities.
And I think Ten stepping in there did help Fabinho towards the back end of the season as well, so especially the way that we set up. But just to draw a line on the Ten thing as well, is like, I think where I get annoyed with it slightly is like, because I think people look past what you get from him in wide areas, you know, the assist and everything he brings. Yeah, we have just watched him getting legged by fullbacks, and the big thing in this is he looks like he's enjoying his football more, which is always important to me. Like I always think it looks great. But this, and by the way, Liverpool deserve huge credit, by the way, that they've produced a player who could literally go on whatever position on that field and do a job and do a bloody good one. But I think when the England thing comes in, I need the rest of the country start chipping in. That's when I get annoyed, because it's like the Gerard Lampard thing all over again. It's like they think they know the answer when they really don't. You know, I've watched Gerrard play left, but he can't play with Lampard yet. That's because he's playing against Bulgaria. You know what I mean? You get found out when they play in the World Cup. And I think it's a similar sort of thing again. And again, with to use the Gerrard comparison, got the best out of him when he played in right midfield on number 10. They were his best numbers.
And
he wants to play centre mid.
The problem with the Trent thing, with the England involvement, ultimately is that unless Liverpool are winning every week, and even then, it'll now be contentious, whatever he does. Yeah. So the Trent and the manager and the club are now on this hook, and that there's, and they can't get off it. The reason why is because some of it's hugely positive. I think there is an awareness amongst people who write and talk about football in a more national sense than sort of focusing in on Liverpool, that he is one of the country's best and most excellent talents of his entire generation. And by that I literally mean the 15-year block. I don't mean like a generation, like it's every 3 years. I mean like literally he'll be one of England's best. He's one of England's three most talented players for any 15 years that he plays in. That will be the case front or back. That's how good he is. That's how special he is. But what that means, though, by extension, is that he drives clicks, he drives engagement. Neville loves talking about him. So that's going to happen every Sunday and every Monday.
That does me in as well.
Every Sunday and every Monday, he's going to get highlighted. He is box office all round. And that's really good, because the reason why he's box office is because he's absolutely brilliant. But there are negative stuff for that, in that, as I say, unless you're winning every week. And also this other thing, whilst he is also nominally marked as a defender, most of the time you can see the goal, a defender's not done something very well. That's literally how football operates.
Testify.
So you're going to end up always around that.
But his mental health, as Jake alluded to, effectively, the boy's happier not being a scapegoat, whether he's a fair...
We're all happy getting on the ball, knocking about against Malta, though, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is that Jurgen Klopp's job is to win games of football for Liverpool. Yeah. It's not to assuage Martin Samuel or Gary Lineker or Gary Neville
to a degree
he needs Trent Alexander-Arnold, but he's got 10 other players, and as we said before, I suspect with this change of shape, Virgil van Dijk's happier, Fabinho's happier.
I also think you haven't yet seen any evidence of Trent not wanting to do the hybrid role. I mean, no. I'm saying that, you know, he's going to... I think you struggle over the course of a season, physically and probably mentally as well, because I'm guessing it is quite draining to go, right, I've had 130 touches of the ball, but also I've got to do these recovery runs when they bring on a fast left winger who, you know, is going to target that area. We haven't seen any evidence. All I've seen really from his body language is positive. I've actually seen him sort of almost like he's been re-energised, in the sense of...
Look, and that's been great to see, hasn't it? Oh, genuinely. Enough's been said about that, I don't think.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. And what also does it say about just him as a player? Gerrard's a great example, really, because I think... A great piece. It was actually about Fernando Torres, I think it was about, but it was about Gerrard, and said how many players of his ability would be willing to put up with as much as he did in his career, in terms of not put up, but, you know, Steven Gerrard looking and saying, why is Momo Sissoko playing in the position that I should be playing in? Like, have you not seen us play? Like, you know, I can do all that stuff better than him. But he did it. And what does it say about Trent, the idea that, you know, okay, yeah, it's not, you know, I'm getting a lot of, I'll go in midfield and sort of help Fabinho out, or, you know, yeah, go on, I'll do a bit of both, or, yeah, I'll you know, if you think Reece James is better than me, go ahead, stick me in midfield and I'll see what I can do. You know, it says an awful lot about his sort of
that was the
courage.
Chat. That was the chat back then, wasn't it? I remember it. I grew up in that era, you know, Gerrard was always, do you want to play centre mid? Yeah. And he was playing out right, or doing Torres' doggies for him up top, but when you look,
I mean,
when
even David Beckham actually had that around chat around him. He was always played wide right, always wanted to play in the middle.
Exactly, but that when you look back at now, like, you know, you used to see Gerrard make a tackle and the clock would roar, or he'd ping one and you go, great ball. But when you look back at it now, actually, he'd done his best work for Liverpool when he was in the box scoring goals or putting a 5-yard pass in for Fernando Torres.
He's memorable. Gerrard, I've been going to Gerrard a little bit, and I think Trent will be similar. He's memorable for what he brought out of others as much as what he did. He'd done some of the most spectacular things I've ever seen on a football pitch. But when you think back to Gerrard's career, you think, God, Torres flew when he played with him. God, Suarez loved playing with him, didn't he? You know, you think of the Michael Owen, you think of like those players that, wow, he made them better. And I think Trent, you know, for someone who's so spectacularly gifted, the fact that he will do what's needed for the team, you know, in midfield, right back, wherever, I think is a massive feather in his cap. And I think it'll really, really, it'll go underrated at the sort of, in the wider discussion, the national discussion. It shouldn't do among Liverpool fans.
We are going to be Trent chatting for the rest of the summer and all time, it may be. Neil, have we got any notices before we wind up for this edition?
Just in general, people would like to subscribe, more than willing to do so. A couple of bits and pieces will be coming out for free this week, which will be really good. But if you can support the Anfield Wrap, there's ways to do so. You just subscribe through apps or through the website. And we'd like people to do that because there's also loads and loads of really good shows behind the paywall as well.
Yes, this a sample of a gutter show, Transfer Gutter Show, which you've been listening to. We'll be doing more of that throughout the summer, three a week. There's two more this week.
You're doing tomorrow?
Tomorrow, yes, the next one. I'm going to be giving you some Barella action. We haven't had time to cover it
today.
We
might actually have the chance to talk about transfers on that one, Rob.
Yeah, we might talk about some actual... Yeah, well, there's going to be some Barella chat, some Mickey van der Ven chat, and I'm really hoping for some more Kefren Turam vibes. Yeah. Tune in. Sports Social Podcast Network.